This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Activists around the world have targeted the Israeli occupation of Palestine through a nonviolent approach called BDS, which stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It's loosely based on the anti-apartheid boycott movement against South Africa. But in what may be a measure of the success of BDS, institutions around the world are now making it illegal to use the tactic. Anti-BDS laws and measures are popping all over, including in California, where the state legislature is now considering a bill. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, where this program is produced, a coalition of more than 50 pro-Israel organizations just wrapped up a conference whose entire focus was to strategize against the BDS movement. Joining me now is Sari Makdisi. He's a professor of English at UCLA. He's the author of several books, including Making England Western, Occidentalism, Race and Imperial Culture, and Palestine Inside Out, an Everyday Occupation. He recently published an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times entitled Wrongfully Treating Academic Debate as Anti-Semitism. He happens to be the nephew of the late Edward Said. Welcome to the show, Sari.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, let's talk about California, since that seems to be the latest front in this war against BDS, if you will. And it just seems to be amazing that a state legislature would be debating or discussing what this is essentially the use of a nonviolent tactic. What exactly is being proposed in California?
Well, actually, there's a couple of things to say about it. First of all, you're right that it is amazing, because I didn't think that states had foreign policies. I mean, states within the U.S. had foreign policies. I thought foreign policy was the prerogative of the federal government, but obviously many of us are mistaken. The second thing that's amazing is that the legislation that's being proposed that just made its way through a committee, apparently, basically it's one of the latest measures that's an attempt to try and turn around, to try and stop the tide of boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. And the interesting thing about it is that it seems on the one hand like an act of strength, and that it's impressive that pro-Israel lobbyists can mobilize even local politicians in places like California to do their bidding. But on the other hand, it's also a sign of sort of panicky weakness, because it shows that BDS has become powerful enough that it requires mobilization against it at this point to try and stop it. But yeah, I mean, the other interesting thing, of course, is that if you try to think back to the 1970s and 1980s to the boycott campaign against South African apartheid, it would have been, I think, unimaginable to think of state legislatures in California or other states trying to stop activism against apartheid in the 1980s, let's say. But here we are. And so, yeah, put it all together and Palestinians are told on the ground that they shouldn't use violence. They're told basically that the political process, which has been dead for 20 years, they can't try and resolve this question through the United Nations. And now, of course, they're not allowed to use nonviolent tactics. So, of course, the big question is, well, what are Palestinians supposed to do exactly?
I suppose when they resist, that they're just expected to disappear or to, to suffer away and out of existence.
Yeah, that's more or less the implication of what we're being told. Yeah, it's actually kind of an astonishing thing. But as I said, you can look at it and see strength on their part, that is, on the part of the forces, defending apartheid. On the other hand, you can also turn it around and say, well, this is a sign of sheer degenerative panic on their part, because it's reached the situation has reached a point now where BDS is, in fact, changing how companies think about how they operate in the Middle East. It's certainly transforming the landscape on university campuses around the U.S. and around the world, for that matter. And this is all an attempt to, I think, belatedly turn the tide. I don't think it's going to be successful in the long run.
So let's talk about what BDS wants. Boycott, divestment, sanctions. Pretty clear-cut three tactics to boycott goods produced in the Israeli, in occupied Palestine, to divest from such companies, and to encourage, I suppose, countries to place sanctions. And the demands that the BDS movement are making are also essentially emancipation for Palestinians, right?
Yeah, well, the kind of three-way demand of BDS in the call by Palestinian civil society is, on the one hand, an end to the occupation of the occupied territories that were captured in 1967. Secondly, the right of return for Palestinian refugees who've been exiled since 1948 and forcibly prevented from returning to their homes inside what's now Israel. And then finally, equality for Palestinian citizens inside the state of Israel, who account for about 20% of the state's population. So yeah, BDS basically, this is again the amazing thing. What BDS is calling for is essentially the standards of international humanitarian law and international law in general to be upheld. That's the kind of sum total demand. It's not some extraordinary thing. It's basic legal decency, legal standards, you know, equality, justice. Those are the things for which BDS is you know, rallying. And it's extraordinary to think that people can be so against the idea of justice, equality, common citizenship, and these kinds of things. But you know, there they are, obviously. Mm.
And so if you listen to the voices that are against BDS, and I mentioned this conference that just wrapped up recently in Los Angeles, whose entire focus was to combat the BDS movement. This wasn't a conference about Israel with one session on the BDS movement. The entire conference, it was called Combating the Boycott Movement Against Israel, in brackets, BDS. So if you listen to them, essentially, this is, you know, if you are a proponent of BDS, you're, you know, maybe committing some sort of hate crime. I mean, they're literally associating BDS with hate. Where's that leap come from? What is the connection between boycott, divestment, and sanctions and hate?
Well, that's a fascinating question. It's a huge question. And it goes beyond the question of BDS as such. So here's how I've been thinking about it. And I've written about this in different kinds of places, but including the LA Times. But many of the people who support Israel in this country, in the U.S., want to think of themselves as liberals, right? So that on questions of, for example, separation of church and state in the U.S., they're very strong partisans of separating church and state and other kinds of liberal concepts in the U.S. So they want to present themselves, and it's more than a veneer. I think they really do seriously think of themselves as wanting to be liberal. On the other hand, they also want to support what is manifestly a racial state and a kind of racist occupation of other people's land. And it's impossible for them to reconcile those two things in their heads. They can't square what it means to want to be, you know, a good kind of liberal on the one hand with, on the other hand, supporting basically a colonial system of apartheid. It's irreconcilable in their own heads. So I think what they do is they turn to it's sort of like a kind of auto brainwashing in a way. They basically turn to new forms of language to try to persuade themselves of the justice of their own position, even though the language they're using is irreconcilable with the reality on the ground that they're espousing. As far as I'm concerned, the most extraordinary example of this remains the Museum of Tolerance here in LA, which, as you may know, it has been for the past 10 years or so.
Yeah.
But they've been trying to build a museum, what they call the Museum of Tolerance in Jerusalem. And they've been trying to build it on the remains of a cemetery, which was one of the oldest, most important Muslim cemeteries in Palestine, dating back to the time of the Crusades. It had been in use, in active use, until 1948. People, you know, present-day Palestinians have family members buried there. And so what the Museum of Tolerance wants to do is to kind of, and it's been actively doing this, as I said, to kind of clear away the debris, get rid of the bodies insofar as they can, put them in cardboard boxes, things like this, and then build on the same site a museum shrine, basically to Zionism, but that they call it the Museum of Tolerance. And it's kind of, you know, it's just, you have to just think, wow, where do you even begin with the concept of having a shrine to so-called tolerance on the ruins of a cemetery that you've actively, you know, participated in desecrating? It's an extraordinary notion. And I think it's indicative of the kind of the process that goes on inside people's heads when they're trying to reconcile ultimately irreconcilable parts of themselves. I think that's part of what we're seeing.
Somebody
who's interested in language, I find it fascinating.
Let's talk about the details of these laws. Bills, in some places, actual laws that are trying to make it illegal to, you know, to support BDS. Are they essentially saying that nobody can boycott Israeli goods, or nobody can promote the boycotting of Israeli goods? I mean, isn't that anybody's right? I mean, if I wanted to boycott all goods from North Carolina, Wouldn't that be my right? How can you make it illegal to call for a boycott of anything? It's a boycott, right? So what are these laws actually saying? How are they even legalizing, being against legalizing, doing away with boycotting?
Well, it has to do with not only kind of the self-justification I was just talking about, but also with the ways in which critical exchange of ideas and arguments and so forth about this, these kinds of questions are basically, there's an attempt now to basically make them illegal. So, for example, we saw recently at the University of California system and other bits, not just UC, but other places around the country too, where there's been a very, very strong push to essentially legally, the attempt is to legally, administratively suppress the criticism of Israeli policy on university campuses.
Right, the UC so regions made it illegal. Exactly. And that's probably also a measure of the success that BDS has had on campuses. So essentially,
They didn't succeed because okay. the measure that was finally approved by the UC regions was to prohibit what it called anti-Semitic forms of anti-Zionism. Which anyway were prohibited because anti-Semitism is it's wrong and it's against
racism.
UC rules anyways.
Yeah,
right. So I mean, so it's just anti-Semitism is another form of racism, which anyway is already prohibited by university regulations. So like nothing actually changed, in fact. But the point is, there has been this move to basically suppress criticism of Israel by tarnishing it with the brush of anti-Semitism and then trying to do away with it under those grounds.
Right.
So
that's an age-old tactic,
similar,
by the way. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, but it's now it has a kind of, there's more of an administrative and political, legislative backing for it, of course, as I said, because these people are finding themselves with their backs to the wall. Now they're just doing whatever they can at this point to try and stem the tide that I think they can't actually stem. At the level of BDS, it's a similar kind of thing. So instead of being able to allow people to make choices, which is what ultimately, you're right, going back all the way to the 1940s and 50s and 60s in this country, boycotts and sanctions, this kind of thing, were always kind of the last resort of people of goodwill and good conscience. But what this kind of legislative and administrative activity wants to do is to take away your freedom of conscience from you and to prohibit you from exercising your freedom of conscience, which is, again, quite an extraordinary thing. And it seems, as I said, you can see it as a sign of strength, but you can also see it as a sign of just rank desperation, which is basically how I see it.
So isn't it also an attack on free speech? I mean, isn't being able to boycott something your right to be able to speak out? And shouldn't it be shouldn't these anti-BDS laws be characterized as attacks on free speech?
Yeah, of course they are. Of course it's an attack on free speech, as I said. So are the attempts to stifle debate about Israel and Palestine and university campuses. It's all attempts. So basically what's happened is, especially on campus, the people who support what's going on in the occupied territories, basically they've lost all the arguments at this point. So now they're going after the very possibility of argument itself. They're trying to suppress argument. They're trying to shut down thought. They're trying to prohibit speech. And I mean, as I said, they can try. I don't think they're going to get very far in the end. They're going to make things very, very uncomfortable. They are already. But you can't stop people from thinking. That's not how the world works. And that's why I see it as kind of a futile effort on their part.
Now, let's talk about other anti-BDS efforts. I understand Canada passed an anti-BDS law. This happened under the Liberal leadership of Justin Trudeau. Even President Obama signed a law last year that apparently was against BDS, but now people are basically saying it was largely symbolic. What are these other efforts?
Yeah, I don't know about other places or other laws, but I mean, as I said, there is a global movement. It's very active in Europe as well. And this is all given, as I said, it's given it lends credence to the success of BDS. In other words, you wouldn't need to suppress something if it wasn't successful. The fact that it's successful is what leads it to need to be suppressed at this point. Mm. So as I said, again, you can look at it as strength, but it's also weakness. If there was nothing there for them to suppress, they wouldn't be suppressing it. The fact is they're desperate to stop it, and they're reaching at everything. And the other amazing thing, and this is true for what goes on university campuses as well, if you go around trying to stifle free speech, you're going to alienate a lot of people very quickly, even people who don't have any particular position on Israel and Palestine, because people believe in free speech in this country, especially in university campuses. So this attempt to try and stop and stifle and suppress and blanketly eliminate everything is, as I said, I think it's desperate and it's doomed to failure ultimately. But as you know, in the short run, yes, it'll make things more uncomfortable than they already are, and you know, that's the name of the game at this point, I guess.
So let's talk about the broader context of everything. That's worth reminding ourselves. I mean, on this program, we do a lot of coverage of the impacts of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the impacts of the Israeli siege on Gaza. How desperate a situation is it? I mean, we've had, you know, so many wars now that Israel has lobbed against Gaza. The whole area has had tremendous trouble rebuilding. People are very desperate. And as you mentioned early in our conversation, BDS was one sort of, you know, tactic, a nonviolent tactic led by Palestinians. There's this attempt to say that BDS is something that outsiders are pushing, but really isn't it a tactic pushed by Palestinians because they're living in desperate circumstances?
Yes, they're living in desperate circumstances and appalling circumstances. And so on the one hand, the Palestinian attempt to resist Israeli occupation using military force has failed and has been largely, I think, abandoned realistically. The second process was an attempt to kind of reconcile or reach a kind of peace, you know, reconciliation with the Israelis through diplomatic means, through negotiations at the level of state actors and this kind of thing, going back to the early 1990s. That, too, has been going on for 20 years. It's gotten worse, if anything. So that, too, has failed. And so given the failure on the military plane on the one hand, and then on the political plane, the diplomatic plane on the other, Palestinian civil society has basically said, well, there's only one method left, which is, you know, civil action rather than either military or diplomatic action. And so therefore the call was issued in the early 2000s by a couple of hundred Palestinian civil society organizations asking the world and citizens of goodwill around the world to engage in BDS, exactly along the lines of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Although, by the way, South African friends often point out that the Palestinian call for BDS is actually far more permissive in terms of what it allows than the South African call, which was much, much more blanket. And nobody from South Africa, whatever their position was, for example, could engage in these in international appearances or sports or so forth. That's not what BDS is calling for. It's much more toned down than had been the case in the South African boycott struggle.
Right.
But yeah, so it is basically, it's the last means available. And as I said, it is now, the amazing thing about it, if you think about it, is that BDS has been proposed. It's certainly not proposed by the Israelis, obviously. It's not proposed by the UN. It's not proposed by any government. It's not proposed by the Palestinian Authority, such as it is. It's been proposed basically by writers and activists and journalists and so forth. So it's extraordinary that something that is going against the stated interests of all these different states, Israel, the U.S., the UN, it's the EU, and so forth, and that is basically being promulgated by writers and activists in newspapers and online and so forth, has now reached such a point that states, legislatures, governments, administrations, and so forth are taking action against it, or that political candidates like Mrs. Clinton, you know, have to be trotted out to denounce BDS, etc. It's an extraordinary state of affairs, as I say. But that's where we are now. That there's a sense of imminent transformation, and that's the struggle over BDS is kind of the focal point at this point.
Well, Sari, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Sari
Makdisi is a professor of English at UCLA, author of several books, including Palestine Inside Out and Everyday Occupation. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.